Those who worship the demigods will take birth among the demigods. Those who worship the ancestors go to the ancestors. Those who worship ghosts and spirits will take birth among such beings. And those who worship me will live with me. Among Vishnu Vraya Krishna Pristai Vuday, Shimade Bhakti Vidanta Swami Namane, Namaste Sarasakam Deve, Koravani Vicharne, Nirvishesha Shindivari Paskatya De Siddharna. Thank you for coming. Bhagavad Gita, which was spoken 5,000 years ago by Lord Krishna, who is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, basically explains about two different types of knowledge. The first knowledge is the difference between the body and the soul. And the next knowledge is knowledge about the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And in between these two types of knowledge is knowledge about how the living entity is getting different bodies. Just like presently, most of the people in the room that I can perceive at least, they all have a human form of life. So we're quite fortunate that we have the human form of life, in that we have the opportunity to hear about something spiritual. Now, as most of us can agree with, that outside there are many living entities, both two-legged and different types of legs, and they're not very much interested in spiritual life. But if we were advertising that we were taking drugs in here or doing something else, then many more people would come here. So it is not that people are not interested in something, some activity, to change their experience. Matter of fact, everyone wants to obtain some kind of pleasureful experience. And everyone is looking to obtain that pleasureful experience for as long as possible. So knowledge means what will give us the greatest pleasure the longest amount of time. The only thing that people differ with is what they think will actually produce that effect. Some people may take one type of activity, like taking drugs or other activities similar to that, as being producing happiness for some period of time. But Bhagavad Gita, as we know, is based upon the premise that there's a difference between the body and the self. And the example that we've heard before is just like if you have a bird in the cage. If you have a bird in the cage, then you may take care of the cage very nicely. You may decorate the cage and clean the cage. But unless you take care of the bird inside of the body by giving him some food, the bird won't be very satisfied. In a similar way, if there's a fish and you take the fish out of water, then you may give him a nice car, you may give him a nice wife, you may give him a nice fish house to live in, an aquarium, without any water in it. But unless the fish has some water, unless he's in his natural environment, he won't be very satisfied. So similarly, we are all spiritual, but now we're in a material concept of life. From the very beginning of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna tries to lessen that material concept of life by explaining something very simple. Krishna explains that the body is changing, as we've heard that before, and all of us can readily agree, I'm sure, that our bodies are changing. But Krishna says that within the body, what essentially makes the body alive and gives the body awareness, there is a soul. But that soul, who's aware of the different changes of the body, is always the same soul. And therefore, in spite of changes of the body, the soul remains the same, and the last change of the body, called death, doesn't mean that the soul dies. It means he simply goes on to take another body with a different set of experiences. Now, how he gets different bodies is explained here. That change of body is due to his conception of life at the time of leaving this body. Or, basically speaking, where he wants to go. Just like, for instance, somehow or another, we've all come here tonight, Because we've heard something. Perhaps we've heard that the food is good at least. So somehow or another we were attracted to come here to this particular house in this particular city at this particular time. Because we heard someone glorified, or we've had some favorable experience, and therefore we wanted to come here. But I think there is probably 5 million people in Amsterdam, at least. How many?
3/4 of a million.
There's only 3/4 of a million?
That's Amsterdam, yeah. Small country.
And 1 million tourists each day.
There's 3/4 of a million people and 1 million tourists. Is that right? It must be quite amazing people. 2 or 3 people come just to watch them. Well, there goes one now. There's actually 1 million tourists here every year? Every day. That means there is 350 million tourists in Amsterdam. And only 3/4 of a million people living here. What do they see here? Anyhow, somehow or another, most of the people in Amsterdam, especially the tourists, didn't come here. Today, at least. But they went somewhere, and where did they go? According to what they heard, the glory, just like on the internet, in the newspapers, on television, on the radio. So many people are glorifying so many different things, and therefore people are going to so many different places in order to see, essentially, if they can become happy there. If they can derive some happiness, some satisfaction, and to see how long that satisfaction will last. But, now if it's true that we're actually not the body, that we're actually a spiritual soul, now how many people are going to become happy trying to derive something that has nothing to do with themselves? Just like, for instance, if you took off your hat and coat and shirt, and suddenly you start to decorate it, or you start to wash it, and you start to make a nice offering of food to it, and you start to take care of it, how much happiness can you derive from taking care of your hat and coat? Can anyone derive unlimited bliss? Oh, my hat and coat, look, it's so nice and shiny and clean, and I just feel so good about it. Let me brush it a little bit more. Oh, that feels really good. So if anyone's wondering why they're not completely satisfied, it's because we're more or less, in the material world, absorbed in a dream. Just like, for instance, if last night you dreamt that suddenly someone came up to you and gave you 100 million guilders to spend any way you wanted. So naturally, in your dream, you would become quite happy. And with your 100 million guilders, you can purchase your dream house, you can get your dream car, you can get your dream wife or dream husband, you can get your dream children, you can have your dream bank account, you can have your dream vacation. Everything will be very nice. But then, who, when they woke up, would suddenly lament that last night I was rich, my life was successful, now I've woken up, I've lost everything. So my life is a failure now. So what to do? The only alternative is to go back to sleep and try and find my dream wife and house again, which I lost last night when I woke up. So similarly now, although we have nothing factually to do with material existence, but somehow or another we're trying to become happy in some kind of dream. Of course, someone's dream may be a nightmare, or someone's dream may be somewhat pleasant, or someone may have a mixture of the two. But in any case, after some time, we go to sleep and we forget all about this life that we're presently living, and we dream something else. As one philosopher said, who's to say that actually I'm a human being dreaming that I'm a butterfly? Maybe the reality is that I'm a butterfly dreaming that I'm a human being. Because the only difference between our daydream and our night dream is simply the difference in time that we're awake or asleep. Of course, for most of us, we'll take our daydream seriously. But Bhagavad Gita tries to establish us in the fact that this is just one lifetime out of many, many lifetimes. And this lifetime is a preparation for our next lifetime. So here it says that there are many possibilities where we're going to go in our next lifetime. It is not guaranteed that although we've been taking birth here on this earth planet or in Amsterdam or in some other place, there's no guarantee that we're going to come back in our next lifetime to the same place. One may go become a demigod. But here it says it's not arbitrary that one becomes a demigod. Because in the Vedic literature, there are rituals, there are sacrifices, there are austerities, there are different principles that one has to follow in order to become qualified to become a demigod. And in this age, of course, most people are not very much aware of what a demigod is, nor are many people aspiring to become a demigod. There is no university that trains you up how to become a demigod. There are many universities training you how to become a demon, though. Most people are becoming trained up to become a demon. A demon doesn't mean that you graduate and you get two horns and a tail. That's what a demon means. A demon means one who's simply interested in gratifying his senses and has little concern with the actual laws of nature. In modern society, most people are only concerned about the laws of nature to see how they can control them. That's their meditation on the laws of nature. But the biggest demon of them all, we do celebrate his disappearance day, though. Although he's a great demon, we celebrate his disappearance day. His name is Hiranyakashipu. His disappearance day we celebrate on the same day as the appearance day of Lord Nrsimhadev. So Hiranyakashipu, he was a great demon, and he was intelligent enough to know that if he was going to control the material world and be happy here, the first thing he would have to do is conquer death. And he was quite determined to do so. So he stood on the tip of his toes for 120 years of the demigods. That's something like 120 multiplied by 180 years, roughly. Some hundreds and thousands of years, he stood on the tip of his toes with his arms upraised, and he was going through so much austerity that the ants came and built an anthill around his body. And then they started to eat his body. And they consumed his body, so the only thing left was his bones. You can imagine if his mother came and saw him. She would have thought, Hiranyakashipu, you're not eating enough. You look like you're all practical bones. But he was actually just bones. But he was so determined to get a bone from the demigods so that he would become immortal that he went through that austerity. And he had the mystic power because in the age of Satya Yuga when he was living, people had the power that the soul could actually live in the bones of the body. Just like in the last age, the Dwarpa Yuga, when the Kshatriyas were fighting, sometimes the weapons would be piercing their bodies. There's descriptions how thousands of arrows are piercing their bodies, but they didn't seem to die. Nowadays, if we step on a thumbtack, you know, immediately we call the ambulance and they rush in to perform major surgery on our foot to get the thumbtack out. But here in the description, there are so many descriptions of battles where the warriors are being pierced, their arms and legs and bodies, their heads are being pierced by arrows and tridents and axes, and yet they don't die because they were able to maintain their life here. And unless their heads were cut off or some major thing like that, they're able to maintain their life here within the body. And in Satya Yuga, people were so powerful that they could, unless they could maintain their life here just in their bones. So Hiranyakashipu was doing that, and then he got the boon from Lord Brahma that he got a body which is practically indestructible. But still, he died. Hiranyakashipu was ultimately, he had his disappearance day. And it wasn't that long after his appearance day, relatively speaking. Although he went through a severe type of austerity and penance in order to achieve immortality, still he was not able to do it. So what to speak of ourselves, what are we doing to become immortal in this world? Going to the local health food store and buying some herbal toothpaste? So when the Yamadutas come to take us away, we'll smile at them and they'll become appeased and they'll go away. What are we doing to assure our immortality? Actually, the fact is, every day we wake up, we're a little bit closer to death. Sorry to be pessimistic. They say the Hare Krishnas are quite pessimistic. So. Didn't want to spoil everyone's day here, but the fact is that everyone is dying. And there's nothing we're doing or can do to actually prevent it. But what we're doing now will determine what body we're going to get in our next lifetime. So, practically speaking, there's no cause to become a demigod. People are, generally speaking, convinced that the only platform of happiness in the material world is sense gratification. We have a whole civilization, modern civilization, more or less dedicated to different varieties of sense gratification. And those who are alternative people, generally, their sense gratification is not simply on the gross platform. They try to have sense gratification on the more subtle platform. And they consider that to be spiritual. But actually, it's not spiritual. And even if one is cultivating activities and philosophy and knowledge and desires on the more subtle platforms, then still it's still in the material world. So here it mentions that there's a different world. There's the world of spirit, of which we have our natural membership in that world. Although we've chosen this virtual reality of the material world, because this material world is just a virtual reality. It has nothing to do with real reality, but it's been given to us. These machines have been created by the greatest virtual reality engineer named Krishna. He's created these multi-dimensional machines called bodies. And in it, we're experiencing all different types of virtual reality because it's not real reality, it just appears to be reality. It's the shadow of real reality. But real reality is mentioned in the Brahma Samhita. Shriya Kanta Kanta Parama Purusha Kapataruvo Truma Bhumis Chintamani Karamayitoyam Amritam Kata Ganam Natyam Gamanam Apivangsi Priya Saki Chit Anandam Jyoti Param Apitaras Vadima Picha Siyatra Shiravi Shravati Surabhi Vyascha Sumahan Nirme Shardarakyo Vavrediti Na Samaya Vajay Sveta Dvipam Tamaham Iha Golokam Itiyam Vidantaste Shiti Charakati Paye. So there it mentions that there's a world known as Sveta Dvip. We know it as Goloka Vrindavan. This is also mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita as Tadama Paramamama. That abode of the Supreme Lord, the Supreme Person, where he lives with all his eternal associates. So there it says, Shriya Kanta Kanta Parama Purusha Kalpa Taruvo. There Krishna is so attractive that even the most attractive personalities, the Lakshmis, the goddesses of fortune, they're overwhelmed with transcendental happiness and love for him. And there, all the trees there are all desire trees. Here, in the material world, the trees, they give leaves. Usually they give leaves. Not much more than leaves. But there, they give whatever you want. If you walk up to the tree, and you ask for some fruits, generally they just ask for fruits to worship Krishna or flowers to serve Krishna with. But somehow or another, if you wanted something else, that desire tree, the Kalpa Riksha tree, it would also provide those desires. Although the devotees are so satisfied in transcendent loving service to Krishna, they simply want something to offer to Krishna. And Druma Bhumis Chintamani, that there the land is made out of touchstone. Here the land is made out of gravel and cement. But there it's all made out of touchstone. And the land is so nice there, just like when Govardhan Hill, there's a hill in India called Govardhan, where Krishna had his pastimes. So the gopis, Krishna's dear associates, they used to be in anxiety that when Krishna would be walking on Govardhan Hill, perhaps he'd step on a pebble and his foot would get hurt. But actually Govardhan Hill is so nice that during the winter, the rocks in Govardhan are very warm. They warm Krishna's lotus feet. And during the summer, when it's very hot, they cool his feet. The rocks become very cool. So the whole spiritual world, the whole Chintamani Dham is like that. When the residents walk there, just like nowadays, if you go to India, it's a little bit different. Because the British and other people, they installed railroads and all these roads. And therefore, if you go barefoot, it's sometimes not very pleasant. But 5,000 years ago, when Krishna was here, there were no thorns, there were no thorn bushes, there were no roads. Everything was transcendentally dusty. Made out of transcendental dust. Everything was very soft. If there were all the flowers and the grass, they all made very nice rugs for Krishna, very nice blankets for Krishna. And the caves in Govardhan would always be nicely heated, just like the rocks were during the summer. They would be cool. And in the winter they'd be heated, they'd be nicely lit up by different types of jewels. So everything is made in the transcendental land of Vrindavan just to satisfy all the inhabitants. And there people don't walk, they dance. And there they don't talk, they all sing. So Śrīla Jīva Gosvāmī says that if the talking there is just like singing, then try to imagine what the singing is like. And if walking there is like dancing, try to imagine what it's like to dance there. And there the flute of Krishna is his favorite attendant. And when he sounds his flute, the sound vibration is so sweet to hear, it is said in one place in the Krishna book, that the aquatic birds, like the ducks, the swan, and the cranes, they stop swimming and flying, and they close their eyes and enter into a trance of meditation worship of Krishna. So there everyone is in transcendental bliss listening to Krishna's music. Although here some music groups have become popular for some very limited time, but the best-selling music group is Krishna and the Flute. That's been popular forever, eternally. And it's predicted to stay on the Goloka Vrindavan's chart. He's scheduled to be on the chart forever, number one. Krishna and his flute with the cowherd boys. And there, it is said that everyone there is enjoyable and tasty. Here, sometimes we like people, sometimes we don't like people. But there, everyone is full of transcendental pleasure. And just by associating with them, we all derive transcendental pleasure, spontaneously. And there, the cows, they give unlimited milk. There's no need to go to the milk store, to the store or a milkman delivering it. You simply go out and there's cows everywhere giving you milk. And everyone there has sandesh and lovedemons and sweet rice, unlimitedly. There's an ocean of milk. And there, time is conspicuous by its absence. Instead of people growing older, every moment people are growing younger. You meet your friend and you say, "Wow, you look so young." How young are you today? So everyone is growing younger at every moment. That is younger in the sense that people are becoming more enlivened, more enthusiastic, their senses are more acute, their senses are stronger, they're more enthusiastic. Everything is ever fresh there. So that land is known to only very few self-realized souls in the world. So although we may make some jokes about it, but the real fact is that it exists. And the real fact is that we're not there right now. We're in Amsterdam. And if you go outside, you'll see, you'll hear that every word outside there is not exactly a song. And people are not exactly dancing in the street. Although everyone is attempting to find the qualities of the spiritual world in this one, but since time immemorial, no one has been able to do it. Therefore, Prabhupada very simply is saying that unfortunately people have no information of these sublime planets. Now, we may not know so much about it or have so much direct experience, but anyone who just utilizes their intelligence a little bit, they'll become convinced that there is such a place and that all of us were fool number one for not wanting to go there. Or anyone who is half intelligent, that they'll become inspired to make some progress towards that transcendental land just if they hear about it. And here it says that in this age, where people can hardly understand about even simple things, that simply by chanting Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, that just by chanting this Hare Krishna mantra, then gradually one will make progress towards going to that sublime planet. Allen Ginsberg, who is a poet, one time he was discussing with Prabhupada in Ohio, in America, about Kali Yuga. So Allen Ginsberg, he had a few bad habits. But still he was a little bit attracted to Prabhupada. So he heard from Prabhupada about Kali Yuga. So he wanted to know, because he didn't have any plans to go into the spiritual world himself personally. So he wanted to know what it would be like at the end of Kali Yuga. So Prabhupada looked at him and said, at the end of Kali Yuga, I eat you and you eat me. So Allen Ginsberg was shocked, because he was in this, everything's getting better, we're in the age of Aquarius or something. So he was shocked. He said, what about your followers, Swamiji? Where will they go? And Prabhupada said, they won't be around here to see all the fun. In other words, although it's predicted for the next 10,000 years, which is not really a whole long time, a very long time, this will be the golden age. But this is the age where we get the opportunity to get out of this Kali Yuga. Because after 10,000 years, it's going to even be a lot less pleasant than it is now. It says at the end of Kali Yuga that the people will be at the size of pygmies. You know, the center and the major league basketball players will be, you know, 1.5 foot tall. They'll be the center for the basketball team. And if people live for 10 years old, when they're 10 years old, they'll be considered old men or women. And the ladies will have children at the age of 5. So that's Kali Yuga. And the major sport in Kali Yuga will be hunting devotees. You get some time off to go for, you know, see if you can find a devotee or two and hunt them. So it won't be very pleasant, especially for the devotees at night. Therefore, once you try and take this seriously, there's no great sacrifice one has to perform with ghee. There's no great austerity, standing on one's head, or fasting for long periods of time. None of these austerities are that important compared to the chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra. In spite of whatever craziness we've acquired since we've been around here for some time, in spite of whatever crazy ideas we have, some or another, if we remain in the association of devotees and chant Hare Krishna and try and understand this philosophy, then gradually some of that craziness will go away, and gradually we'll wake up to our actual identity as a spiritual being, and we'll wonder why I wasted so much time here in the material world simply dreaming about useless things that never really amounted to very much. So this is recommended here, that we chant Hare Krishna, and that if we want to do good to others, we should also tell them about the chanting. This, practically speaking, is the only real benefit that people will get in this modern age of Kali Yuga. So I think I'll stop there. Thank you for listening. Are there any questions? Yes.
You compare the body to a kind of coat.
Yeah. When we leave the body, we say the body is dead. It's the same body. And you take a knife and stick it into the dead body. It doesn't feel anything. So it's not the body that feels it. It's we feel it. And sometimes people are still in the body, just like out of body experiences, but they don't feel the body. They don't feel pleasure or pain. And sometimes people are under hypnotism and they don't feel anything. Or they're anesthetized. So it's not the body that feels, it's the soul that feels. It's not the body that's perceiving, it's the soul that's perceiving. But now it's perceiving through the material body. Anything else?
Yes.
Even people who are completely atheistic make a distinction between clean and unclean. So where does the perception of cleanliness come from, I mean?
Cleanliness?
Yes. As I understand, of course, the pure consciousness that's when it is in relation with the spiritual world.
Well, ultimately...
Even atheistic people have this distinction.
Not always. They don't know what's clean and what's not clean. Krishna says, Pravritim cha, Navritim cha, Jana na vidura asura, Nasatyam napichachara, Nasatyam napichachara, Nasatyam teshu vidyate. That people don't know in this age what is to be done and what is not to be done. Neither cleanliness, nor proper behavior, nor truthfulness is found in it. People have no idea what cleanliness is. When the devotees first from Russia, they came to India. The people were amazed because we put tilak so the devotee on our foreheads. That's this. So the devotees there, because they had no idea about cleanliness, they used to spit into the hand and then rub the tilak. So they had very little idea of cleanliness. Most people, like when I'm book distribution or I'm traveling, you'll see people go into the restroom. They do their business there, and very few people actually wash their hands. You see people, they take their dog after the dog is licking its behind, and they're kissing the dog. So what is their concept of cleanliness? What do they mean by cleanliness? They eat at the table, the dog's eating there with them, licking their plate. So where is there any question of cleanliness? What is the limit of cleanliness? And there's one country near here where people, if they take a bath once a month, it's only, you know, out of habit. Just so that they, you know, just out of ritual. Even if they think themselves clean, still once a month they take a bath. So where is there any question of people thinking themselves clean? It's all relative. Our standard of cleanliness is that originally we're pure in consciousness. Originally we're Krishna conscious. And now artificially we're covered. We have a covered identity. So real cleanliness is to come back to our original spiritual identity in relation with Krishna. So until that identity in relation with Krishna is uncovered, it will be considered to be in a contaminated or unclean condition. No matter how much we wash our hands or you know, wash our clothes, still, if our consciousness is not pure, we're considered to be in an unclean state. Yes?
Mark, someone might say that all the religions always talk about the result of not being religious, especially like, okay, in the Christian tradition, they'll say, that, you know, if you don't surrender, you go to hell. And in Krishna consciousness movement, we say, if you don't get out of the material world, you'll come back to as a pygmy or something like that. They make
if you're lucky. You may come back as a pet of one of the pygmies. Yeah, I mean, a little fear is good for everyone. Because it's reality. Just, if you go outside and you talk to the trees, if you have that ability, you'll find out that most of the trees, they thought they were actually going to heaven. They had no fear. They were convinced. They gave their 50 cents in charity to the church. And they were sure that they were going to go to heaven. But now they wound up as a tree somewhere. Because they were fearless. They engaged in every kind of sense gratification imaginable because they had no fear. They didn't listen to those pessimistic Hare Krishnas trying to discourage them from enjoying life. And now they're trees. So that's reality. So a good little bit of fear is a good thing. Not that I'm so fearful that I won't do anything except to gratify my senses because I'm too fearful. But a little fear of doing the wrong thing is good. And as far as this is dogmatic, is some kind of something invented by religionists that actually we're all going to heaven or there is no heaven, we're all, you know, at the end of this lifetime is all void. Well, that's what philosophy is meant for. That can be discussed. Our basic premise is that our body's changing and that we, the soul within the body, are always the same. So if someone can dispute that basic premise, then we can argue that there is no soul or there is no God. But our basic premise is that there is a God, there is a soul, and there are the laws of karma. And we may believe in them, we may not believe, but we're under them and we'll get the reaction. We'll get the results of what we do. Yes.
Can the soul be completely happy as long as there are conditioned souls around?
Yeah, sure, why not?
Because, yeah, they are in a suffering state.
No, anyhow, a soul, when he's actually with Krishna, who's completely happy, he's by nature full of bliss, he becomes completely blissful. Just like if you're in the middle of a fire and everyone else is outside the fire, can you become warm? Everyone else, you're in the middle of the fire and you're burning, and everyone else is outside in the freezing cold, and they're going, it's not fair, you can't get so warm because we're out here in the cold. No, you'll get hot if you're in the fire. So if we're Krishna conscious, we'll become blissful, even if everyone else is suffering. Now, one who's Krishna conscious, just like Krishna himself, is coming to deliver the fallen souls. So one who's actually Krishna conscious, he'll work to help others become blissful also. But that's everyone's individual choice, whether or not they want to take to Krishna consciousness. As the old saying goes, you can bring a person you can bring a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. So it's everyone's free will whether or not they accept Krishna or not. We can't force people to accept Krishna, but we can encourage them. Yes.
I read that demigods want to take birth in this age because it can make peacefully progress in spiritual life. But are they aware that they being born here then? Are they aware that they...
No, of course not. We're not demigods. We're not anything. We're spiritual beings. So when we take birth in a certain place, we forget our last lifetimes.
Should one think of the spiritual world, like you're describing, and Krishna, even if one has not yet realized? Because then,
why not? It's like if you want to go to, you may want to go to Hawaii. So you see posters, you hear about it. Otherwise, why would we want to go there? Not that I'm not going to hear about Hawaii until I go there. Anything else? Yes. No, it may be their karma, but you've chosen to interfere with their karma. You've chosen to do it. So you'll get the reaction for it. Now, if you decided not to do it, maybe someone else would have come along and done it. Maybe. They would have gotten the result. But you decided that you are the one who wanted to step in and get the result. So you get the result. Well, not necessarily. Human beings, if they're spiritual, acting spiritually, they can transcend karma. Everything is not automatically predestined. The Krishna factor is there also. But in any case, the animal, if it was destined, yeah, even the animals, Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had the animals dance in ecstasy in the Jarikanda forest. So he, by his potency, was able to get them to transcend their animal nature. But as far as interfering, yes, we're interfering. Now, we may say, well, someone is going to interfere, because it's an interference, because of the animal's karma. But then, you know, the point is, we shouldn't interfere. I think it's time for the RT, right? So thank you very much. Grantharaj, Srimad Bhagavad Gita, Ki Jai. Srila Prabhupada, Ki Jai. For Grande Heaven.